This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic.
Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest. If
no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
If you're a young Australian, you're one of the groups most at risk of becoming homeless. That's the facts. Thousands of Australians under the age of 24 have nowhere to live, and many of them are forced to sleep on the streets. The government this week announced some money to deal with this massive problem. How much of a difference is it going to make? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we look at homelessness and hear from those who really are struggling to get by. And I want to know if you're one of these people who is either, you know, experiencing homelessness now or you have in the past. Tell me about your experience, how you got out of that experience, if you managed to. Message in 0439 757 555. Later in the show, we're going to get to our long listen of the week, and we're sitting down with one of Australia's biggest creators and arguably the country's most famous sex worker, Kayla Jate. And she talks about a few things, explaining why she's decided to open up about her life in a new book.
You know, sex workers are real people at the end of the day. It's just a job. So I guess showing that side that people don't usually hear about.
Yeah, that chat is coming up later. First, though.
Hack.
A cruise of a lifetime tainted by a deadly outbreak.
On Triple J.
Yeah, if you've been following the news over the past few weeks, you would have seen stuff about this hantavirus cruise ship, reminding a lot of people of COVID, people trapped on board who'd been diagnosed, others doing everything they could not to contract the virus, including some Australians. Well, that group of Aussies and a Kiwi who've been stuck for weeks are finally on their way home. The Australian government and health experts say we shouldn't be worried. We're going to have an expert on in a minute to talk through exactly what this virus is and, you know, what the symptoms are. But first, Shalala Medora with this update.
I've just come from a briefing from the Centre for Disease Control.
Health Minister Mark Butler had good news for the six cruise ship passengers at the centre of a hantavirus outbreak.
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has secured a suitable aircraft and crew to transport the four Australian citizens, the Australian permanent resident and the New Zealand citizen from where they are now in the Netherlands to Australia.
The six arrived in the Netherlands earlier this week after the MV Hondius docked in Spain's Canary Islands.
There are, as the World Health Organization reports now, 11 cases. All of those cases of hantavirus are from passengers or crew members, people from the cruise ship.
The MV Hondius left Argentina on April the 1st with about 150 people on board. 5 days later, people started getting sick. An elderly Dutch couple were the first to show symptoms and eventually died from the hantavirus. Other passengers on board were put into lockdown in early May.
I am currently on board the MV Hondius, and what's happening right now is very real for all of us here. We're not just a story. We're not just headlines. We're people.
American travel influencer Jake Rossmarin was one of the people on board. He's now in quarantine in the States.
I feel good right now. I'm happy to be in a place where I know we are well cared for, and if anything happens, we have the medical attention that we need.
All the passengers are now off the cruise ship, with some already home and others quarantining in the Netherlands. Earlier in the week, British paratroopers airdropped aid to a UK citizen on a remote island suspected of having contracted the virus. Captain of the Hondius, Jan Dobogrovsky, praised the strength of those aboard the ship.
I must commend my crew for their courage and the selfless resolve that they showed time and again in the most difficult moments.
There have been three deaths as a result of the cruise ship outbreak, but the health minister is urging calm.
I want to stress this is still, on all of the evidence, a virus that is very rarely transmitted from human to human.
The repatriation flight carrying the five Australians and one Kiwi will arrive in Perth tomorrow, and none of that six has tested positive or shown symptoms for the hantavirus.
They will be subject to testing when they arrive in Australia.
But the government isn't taking any risks.
All passengers and all crew members will travel this flight for its duration in full PPE.
When the flight arrives in Perth, everyone will be sent to the Bulsbrook Quarantine Facility, a centre set up in response to the COVID pandemic. The World Health Organization recommends a quarantine period of 42 days, though it hasn't mandated it. Mark Butler says the Australian government has mandated 21 days, with the possibility of extending further.
The quarantine order remains in place for 3 weeks, but will be reviewed during those 3 weeks to determine what should take place for the remainder of the 42-day period.
He's working with the states where the Aussies usually reside to determine what happens next.
Maybe that someone wants to float the idea of home-based quarantine back in Queensland and New South Wales.
Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Maduro reporting there. Look, let's get into this a little more now because there has been a bit of concern in the community. People wondering what hantavirus is, how it spreads, if there is some risk of an outbreak in Australia. Well, some of those questions we can get answered from Professor Catherine Bennett, who's an epidemiologist with Deakin University and joins us now. Professor Bennett, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
I do.
What can you tell us about hantavirus? What is it exactly?
Well, it's a virus that thankfully we haven't seen in Australia. This particular strain has been reported in outbreaks, particularly in places like Argentina before, so in South America. So it's called the Andes strain. And unlike some of the other hantaviruses, it has been shown to be likely to spread person to person in really close contact situations. So what happens is it's in the wild rodent community. Someone accidentally gets contaminated either by rodents, or they might be sweeping up an outdoor shed. You might inhale some particles that include the virus unknowingly. And if that person then becomes unwell and has an infection, they then produce enough virus with this strain that they can potentially infect close contacts. And that is sadly what looks like it's happened on the ship. The ship in many ways is kind of like a household. It's that more close contact. You see the same people at mealtime, all of those things that then mean that this virus has a chance of spreading person to person. So unusual virus in that it's only in a certain part of the world where we've seen that happen to now. But of course, the other thing is someone brought it on from that part of the world onto the ship. And of course, we've got people from all around the world on the ship who are now caught up in this, unfortunately.
There has been a lot of concern, Professor Bennett, you know, and there've been some really intense headlines, people saying it's more deadly than COVID, the worry about another pandemic. Is that something that could happen?
Yeah, look, it is not a risk for pandemic, thankfully, very low risk. You know, the virus would really have to change. And what we're seeing at the moment is typical of how it's behaved in outbreaks over the last decade. You know, so this is not a new virus. It's a terrible virus, though. You know, people who do become unwell can become very unwell, and we know that a number of people have already passed away in this particular outbreak. And the people that they might be vulnerable because they've got other conditions, elderly people might be more vulnerable, anyone who gets a really big infecting dose might be more vulnerable. But we just have to manage this as a serious outbreak to protect the people who've been exposed and to make sure anyone who does maybe still go on to develop the disease, that they're really looked after, that they're managed through their symptoms, that they've got the best chance of getting through the infection. The risk of it spreading more widely, though, is very low. Okay. And that's the good news story. This isn't a very efficient virus spreading to person. It needs close contact and pretty sustained contact. That said, you know, they're obviously taking every precaution, and that also should make us all feel a bit more safe that, you know, they are really making sure that people who've come off the boat, who've been isolating in their cabins, aren't put at more risk by being put together with other people off the boat, but also that they're not posing a risk to those people helping to bring them home.
As we heard before, the Health Minister, Mark Butler, has said those Australians heading back home are not symptomatic. Could they still be carriers of the disease, though?
Well, that's why they're wanting people to be in quarantine. This virus can incubate, so it means you're not infectious and you don't have any signs of the illness. But if someone's picked up the virus, it can slowly build up in their system. So that for this virus can be anywhere between 2 and 6 weeks usually, but up to 8 weeks is, you know, in more extreme cases. What we saw on the boat was we had someone who they think, you know, that we call them the index case, the person who probably brought the virus on board was the first death reported, wasn't recognised as Hanta because it presented like a flu, but then he became very unwell quickly and passed away. But it was about just over three weeks for some, that we saw around at that stage, I think there's probably 2, 4, 6, I'm just counting my spreadsheet, but 7 people in who seemed to be infected from that first case. And they were all between kind of 18, 24 days. So it can take that long for someone who was exposed to then develop symptoms. We don't know when people become infectious, but the suggestion is it might be after symptoms, which would be helpful because then at least you know someone's unwell and they can be managed for being infectious at the same time. It could be just as they, on the cusp, as they develop symptoms. Okay. But people who are testing negative, symptom-free and remain that way, we know that if they land in Australia, they're still testing negative, they're still well. That then tells us that they wouldn't have been infectious on the flight. And that's good news for the people who've travelled with them to bring them back to Australia. So every day where we don't have more cases, particularly amongst those 6 people coming back to Australia, is good news because it also tells us we haven't had more exposure days in recent times either.
Well, look, thank you very much for that update. Probably relieved a lot of people listening now who were a bit unsure, a bit uncertain. Professor Catherine Bennett from Deakin University, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Hack.
I think it was sort of the first time where I really felt like someone was actually paying attention, actually listening to what was going on for me.
On Triple J.
We spoke a bit yesterday about the federal budget and the changes that the government is making to help, it says, more young people get into the housing market. But one thing we didn't really touch on is what it's doing to help people sleeping rough, because there was an announcement there in this budget over the past few days, it includes a big investment in social housing to unlock more homes for young homeless people. Is it enough, though? Well, Shannon Schubert's been speaking with some of those at the front line of homelessness in Melbourne.
I was just spending a lot of time, like, sleeping at my friends' houses or just really finding any way to not be around my family home.
Homelessness crept up on Miles slowly at first. When things started to get violent at home, looking for other places to live took its toll.
It makes it hard to keep up with work. It makes it hard to study. It makes it hard just to plan for your future as well, because you don't really know where you might be in the next month to 6 months' time.
Around 40,000 young people seek support from homelessness services every year. Miles is one of them. They reckon they often get turned away when asking for help.
So it's kind of like, as a young person, you then have to learn how to almost work the system to get the support you need, even though, like, we all need the support, and they're sort of turning people away if a certain answer makes them believe that you're in a good enough position.
When the government handed down its budget on Tuesday, it included $60 million to help people like Miles. The money will be spent over 4 years to unlock housing for young people on youth allowance and app study. Here's the Special Envoy for Social Housing and Homelessness, Josh Burns.
You know, our social security system is disadvantaging young people. It's a problem that is by design. We listen to the community, we listen to young people, we listen to the sector.
Homelessness services reckon it's a monumental step forward.
We are celebrating this massive win, which is smart policy.
Shauna Moore is the CEO of Hometime, a national coalition of community organisations.
It does fix a flaw that has harmed young people for decades. The supplement is a cycle breaker and will save lives and provide lasting economic benefits. We're just wrecked.
But she says housing organisations were hoping for a bigger commitment to build more social housing.
It would have been great to see more social housing in this budget, but we will continue to call on federal and state governments to invest in more social housing.
But because our material aid room flooded.
Tanya Corrie is the CEO of homelessness charity Juno. She's showing me around their Melbourne office.
We're keeping all of our material aid in here.
She reckons the new funding is a good thing, but says it doesn't include wraparound support, so she fears young people like Miles will still fall through the cracks.
And we're just so under-resourced. Inevitably, we just can't meet demand.
Juno helps women, trans and gender diverse people and children in Melbourne's north experiencing homelessness or family violence. It says services it works with are turning people away because there's lots more people needing help.
It's definitely getting harder and just people waiting longer because there's just not enough housing.
Tess Power's a social worker at Juno. She reckons things are going to get worse before it gets better.
Demand, yeah, is always increasing, especially with the cost of living and also with the changes in the housing system, like the public housing demolition. I think there's a big risk in those demolitions being pushed on to private developers, and that also risks increasing homelessness.
Over two-thirds of Australian women who experience intimate partner violence move away from their home when the relationship ends. But this is becoming harder and more expensive. In Melbourne, the rental vacancy rate is 2.5%, and the median weekly rent, $580.
It's just so hard to sustain private rental. So, yeah, there's definitely been a slight change in the people who are coming and accessing. Many people have never accessed services before.
The Victorian government recently committed $26 million to expand outreach and emergency accommodation for people sleeping rough and build 7,000 new social housing properties over the next 10 years. But organisations are calling for 8,000 social housing homes to be built every year. Tanya is worried without more funding, Juno will have to close its doors.
We're just so constrained. So the best we can do often for someone who's homeless is a couple of nights of crisis accommodation in a dodgy motel somewhere.
And they might have to stop programs that offer wraparound support. Tess says that will impact programs that help people get a job and stay on top of their finances.
We don't like have funding to kind of support people long term. So once they find housing, they're kind of left on their own.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Shannon Schubert reporting down. Yeah, big issue, we know. We're going to stay on that. Youth homelessness affecting so many people. Hearing from a lot of you yesterday when we were talking about the budget, saying, can't afford to survive, I'm couch surfing, I'm technically homeless. Someone on the text line now saying, glad to see something finally being done. Sad it's taken this long, though. All right, we're going to move on and get into our long listener of the week.
Hack.
The sex worker turned social media star, one of the country's top female influencers.
On Triple J.
She's one of Australia's biggest creators, arguably the most well-known sex worker in the country. Millions of followers hanging off her updates, her stories, her advice. Kayla Jade started an OnlyFans a few years ago before moving into full-service sex work. And now she's written a book to talk about her experiences. She says a lot has been written about her. She wanted to get stuff in her own words. The good, the bad, the hilarious, the scary. It's called Call Girl Confidential. And blue-eyed Kayla Jade is with us now to talk about it. Kayla Jade, welcome to Hack.
Thank you. That was a great intro.
Yeah, thank you.
Loved it.
It's a great book and I feel like people are going to be hooked on this from page one because you really do just throw people right into your world from that first page. Like you're describing a full-on but hilarious scenario with a client and you're trying to come to terms with this very intense experience that you're going through and you say that your mind is just going, think of the money, think of the money, think of the money.
Yes.
My question is, how often are you just thinking of the money to get through?
All the time. Well, it's a business transaction, right? It's like a job at the end of the day, so I'm always thinking about the money, I guess.
And some of the situations you find yourself in can be pretty unusual, to say the least. Why did you think it was important to write this book?
I guess just to sort of show that, you know, sex workers are real people at the end of the day. It's just a job. So I guess showing that side that people don't usually hear about. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, media attention about sex workers. So I guess it's just showing the good, the bad and the ugly, really.
What was your relationship with money growing up? Because you talk about this a bit in the book, how, you know, you struggled and your parents struggled and then you ended up moving to Australia. Was it the money that convinced you that OnlyFans was the thing to do?
I think initially, yes. Like I saw that a lot of people were making, a lot of women were making money online through OnlyFans. So, you know, that definitely did entice me to start doing it, yeah. But before that, I lived paycheck to paycheck. Like I never went like hungry or anything, but you know, I had like duct tape on my car. I couldn't really afford to buy the things I wanted to. So I guess this industry has made me have like financial security, which is incredible.
We actually share some similarities when it comes to work, which may surprise you, but we both started at the deli counter of the supermarket. First job. Yeah. I mean, do you look at your life as it was in New Zealand growing up and then look at where you are now and the situations you've been in? You talk about in the book one of your clients being this A-lister who you cannot talk about in terms of their actual identity. You describe the experience, but you can't reveal who they are. Yes. Do situations like that, you reflect on them and go, how did I get here?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, I especially now that I've had time to reflect back, like writing this book, I went through every memory of like what I've been through in sex work. And some things would come up and I'm like, wow, I actually did that. Like, it's crazy.
Are there misconceptions that kind of frustrate you sometimes or just thoughts people may have about you or presume about you?
I think there's a lot of like misconceptions in the media for sure, especially around sex work. Like a lot of people think that, you know, you can just get into the industry and make a bunch of money. And, you know, that's really not the case. Like a lot of OnlyFans creators, like I think majority make less than minimum wage. So I guess the media can sensationalize it a little bit. So yeah, it's good to show the full picture.
For all of the good experiences, there are some, you know, really, really hectic experiences you've had as well. And in the book, you talk about one particularly horrible time where you were abused. Mm-hmm. And the chapter's actually called The Time I Thought I'd Die. And you were doing a collab with another creator. Do you think it's a case that some of the content that is being created, it appears consensual, but it's actually not?
Yes, yeah. There's definitely a lot of porn getting created like that. You know, anyone can be a creator. Anyone can, you know, get a camera and get a setup and be like, right, I'm, you know, starting content now. So I think that's the difference of, you know, OnlyFans compared to the porn industry, because nowadays the porn industry is very much like there's consent forms, there's like 10 people around. It's very much like it's a process. And I guess a lot of people will just go into OnlyFans and not think about, you know, people's boundaries and things like that.
What do you think of other big creators, like people like Bonnie Blue, for example? Because there's a particular style of headline-grabbing sex work and creating that has become really popular. Mm. What are your thoughts on that?
Like, I try not to engage too much in the rage bait content. I think sometimes it does do a little of disservice to people in the industry. So yeah, I think it's important to show like all aspects, even the bad.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with adult creator, sex worker, Kayla Jade, about her new book that she's got out and her life. Kayla, knowing everything you do about sex work, about OnlyFans, all the stuff you've been through, the good and the bad, is this kind of work something that you would recommend for young women?
Definitely not, no, because I feel like I got into the industry in the right time of my life. Like, I'm glad that I started when I was in my late 20s. Like, if I had started fresh 18, I probably would have made some silly mistakes. So I was really in the right time of my life. And I guess I always say to young people, like, make sure you've explored all your avenues, like, because this could potentially affect your career, relationships. Yeah, I have people that don't talk to me because of the work I do, you know.
Really?
So, yeah, like, you know, some people aren't okay with it. Like, it is still stigmatized. So, yeah, you just got to be mindful of that.
Was that hard to come to terms with initially when you found that it was impacting, you know, relationships or perceptions of you?
It was, yeah, it was hard, but I think those people in my life, I'm okay with them not being in my life. Like, I'm happy and, you know, that's all that matters. And it shouldn't be an issue what I do for work, as long as it's legal, it's not hurting anyone. It's very much normalized, I guess, in nowadays. Like, you know, nurses are having OnlyFans and baristas and stuff. Like, it's very much in our culture.
Kayla, you've got kids and you make a big effort not to reveal too much about them for obvious reasons. And in the book, like, you change their names and that sort of thing. There has been this big push to find out heaps about your personal life. How hard has that been to deal with?
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard, especially because, you know, that's what we're taught in sex work is to not talk about our personal lives online. Well, to other clients, I guess, because, you know, you could have clients that start stalking or things like that. They get a little too in love and they want to push those boundaries a little bit. So, yeah, that's why I wanted to keep it private. It was violating to have people talk about me and my kids and me being a mother online. But, yeah, I had a following that was really, really supportive of it. So, yeah, I'm fortunate for that.
In the book you write, when people ask if I fear being judged as a parent, they forget that I became a parent at the age of 21, so I've always been judged.
Yeah.
What do you make of the intense interest in how you're raising your kids? Because I've seen a lot of interviews with you and people ask you about it. Like, oh, are you worried about this? And when they get older, are you worried about how they're going to reflect on this? Does that annoy you?
It does, but I mean, I think it's just becoming so normalized that I don't think there is as much stigma as there used to be. We're having more conversations about sex work. So I think the more we talk about it, the more open people will be about it.
You got an ADHD diagnosis at the age of 30 and you said it felt like you were the last one to know.
Yeah.
How has that diagnosis changed the way that you view life?
Oh, it's changed incredibly. Like, it was like putting, you know, puzzle pieces together and it just made sense. Like all the things in my childhood and growing up, I was like, oh, that's the reason why I acted that way. So, yeah, it was very therapeutic to learn that I had ADHD. I struggled in a 9-to-5. Like I really struggled with, you know, people telling me what to do and things like that. So, yeah, this work has just given me the freedom to be able to set my own hours, which is great.
I want to talk about something that mate got a lot of attention last year, Peggy Sue.
Yes.
For people who don't know, basically you made a heap of TikTok videos talking about a particular client called Peggy Sue, or you called Peggy Sue for obvious reasons. And you alluded to the fact that this person was successful, big end of town, high stress job. And then this rumour started, not from you, this rumour independent of you started that it was the then opposition leader, Peter Dutton.
Yes.
And in your book, you have made it very clear it is not him. Can I just say that? It absolutely is not. But the rumour spread like wildfire and you wrote, did I inadvertently win Labor the 2025 election? Maybe.
Yeah.
Was it a surprise to you how much that took off?
Oh, it was a crazy thing. Like, I think it just blew up even more than my social media because I would see people commenting about it and they'd be like, oh, who's Kayla J? Like, what has she got to do with it? And yeah, so it was a crazy thing. It just completely blew up. Yeah, it was funny. He was on like when everything was going off, he was on a morning show and he wouldn't deny it. Like they asked him like, are you Peggy Sue? And he wouldn't. Deny, like he wouldn't confirm or deny it. And
you're
think,
like,
I guess,
just deny it. I know it's not
I know.
You.
And I guess that like his PR team maybe was like, oh, don't say anything. And so he really took that seriously. But
I mean, can you clear it up? People want to know, who is it?
I mean, I'm very careful on client confidentiality. So yeah, I'm not going to say who it is. But
was that hard?
It wasn't Peter Dutton.
It wasn't Peter Dutton. Was that hard in the book sharing all these stories and having to be super conscious of your clients and their probably desire to remain, you know, anonymous and not wanting to have their private stories shared?
Yeah, well, I'm always careful with what I post online. Like I never would post personal details or anything like that. If a client asks me to not talk about him, I will respect that. But I think now a lot of people who do book me, they know who I am. So if they were not okay with me talking about them online, they probably would steer clear of me. Yeah.
For all the wild stories you tell in the book, and there are a lot, there is also some really heartwarming stuff. Obviously, when you're talking about your family, but also when you're talking about some clients who you developed a bond with, and, you know, there was one that stuck out to me. It was a man who lost his wife to cancer.
Yes.
And you say that sometimes there are clients that really stick with you. That must be a lot to have that trauma and then also be trying to do your job. What's that like navigating that?
Yeah, I think especially early on I struggled with that because, you know, it took a while to, you know, you're meeting these people and hearing their stories. So, but it was great for them to be able to communicate that with me is awesome. Like, yeah.
There are going to be people out there who are saying, oh, Kayla Jade's just profiting off smart and, you know, is adding to big problems like porn addiction, sending society down a bad path. I know that you've probably heard this stuff before. What do you say to that?
Yeah, look, I don't think anything that I do is wrong because I'm sharing the full picture. Yeah.
Well, look, thank you very much for having a chat with us. The book is a really interesting read and I'm sure people are going to love it. It's definitely, you can't put it down. Once you start reading it, you're in it for the long haul. Kayla Jade, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to listen to the full interview with Kayla Jade, check out Hack's podcast. We've got the extended interview up there. That is all we've got time for on Hack for now. Hack.